Welcome to In Context, WPKN's live public affairs show. I'm your military affairs commentator, WPKN's military affairs commentator, Marshawn McDermott Rowe. You can hear In Context every Monday from noon to 1, except the first Monday of the month when WPKN's General Manager Steve reports to listeners. Our website is incontextreport.com. You can check us out on Facebook at In Context. And you can see our videos on YouTube at In Context Channel Report. I'm sorry, In Context Report Channel. There we go. On YouTube. With me is my fellow host, Gus Cantavero.
Hello. With the cold today, my voice is pretty rough. That's why March is reading the intros. I probably won't participate too much today, but we'll see what I have to say.
You're a trooper for coming in, Gus. Really.
Thanks.
And joining us by phone is our host, Ken McDermott Rowe.
Hi, good afternoon, listeners, and Gus and Marchand.
Hey, Ken. How's your foot?
It's getting there. It's still attached.
Yeah, well, that's good.
Yeah, we got one in the hospital and one with a cold. Well, I mean, I'm kind of worried what's going to happen to me next.
we carry on.
We make a sorry team here, but whatever.
But this is the last In Context for the month, so it's our monthly war report. Where we review the latest developments in the global wars and interpret their military and geostrategic significance. And as far as I know, this is the only show of its kind, a regular review of its kind, that's anywhere on TV or radio. So a big thanks to our listeners at WPKN who keep this show possible and keep WPKN independent and strong. And recently, this is the deal. After 8 days of fighting, which took the lives of 166 Palestinians and 6 Israelis, the Israelis and the Palestinians in Gaza agreed last Wednesday to a ceasefire. It was brought about largely through the intervention of the United States and Egypt. So in today's show, we're going to look at the ramifications of the ceasefire agreement, what the outlook is for a renewed war, and we want to particularly focus on reports that haven't been surfaced in the U.S. media, but they've been abroad, that U.S. troops are going to be stationed in Egypt's Sinai to help enforce the ceasefire. That's what we've been hearing from foreign newspapers, that U.S. troops are going to be stationed in Egypt's Sinai to help enforce the ceasefire. So, but Marshawn, before we get into the details of the ceasefire, let's bring our listeners up to speed, especially those who may not have been following these events very closely. Let's start with where Gaza is in relation to Israel, what these two sides are fighting about, and how the dispute between the Palestinians in Gaza and the Israelis fits into the larger struggle in the region that we've been talking about regularly for the last 2 years.
Well, first of all, Gaza itself is located on the southern west coast of Israel. It is a tiny sliver of land that borders both Egypt's Sinai Desert to the south, Israel to the east and north. So it's roughly twice the size of Fairfield County. So kind of give our listeners an idea of its landmass, about twice the size, I think, of Fairfield County, and with a population of roughly 1.7 million people.
And so it's not contiguous with the rest of Palestine, which is on the West Bank, on the other side of Israel.
Exactly. The West Bank is further north and east of Israel.
Okay. Now, what were they fighting about, basically, and how did the issues involved in the Palestinian-Israeli dispute fit into the bigger picture in the region?
Well, it's kind of a big question. I mean, what really happened, and this can, you know, a lot of people assume the war either began with Israel assassinating the Hamas's military leader, El Jaber, who was the head of the Qassam Brigades. But in reality, there have been back tit-for-tat attacks. And it's kind of like one of those cases of the chicken or the egg, because Israel would drop a bomb in Gaza, Hamas would launch a rocket. Hamas would launch a rocket, Israel would drop a bomb. And it was back and forth and back and forth until 2 weeks ago, Israel decided to assassinate the leader of the Qassam Brigades, the Hamas's military wing, by dropping an airplane bomb on him, which usually does the trick.
But leading up to that, there were rockets being fired from Gaza. So people would argue that this was in retaliation to the rocket attacks.
Absolutely. I mean, that's why it's, you know, if we want to get really to the source of it, it began a long time ago. And as to who fired the first rocket, it's, you know, the Lexington right. and Concord question.
I mean, the thing that I find kind of, I don't know, hard to put a finger on, especially when you try to follow this argument in the mainstream media, you know, they say, oh, they always try to pin the blame squarely on the Palestinians, like, no question. That they start all conflict basically in the Middle East, but they say that the assassination of the Gazan leader was in retaliation to the rocket attacks, but then the rocket attacks are in retaliation to them being stuck in a ghetto.
Well, you both exactly. mentioned the rocket attack. It's been argued that the Israelis sort of embraced the larger conflict in order to take the opportunity to destroy the Palestinians in Gaza as their new rocket potential.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think this was the real motive? In any event, despite the fact that the Israelis destroyed many of the Palestinian civil government buildings, were they successful in degrading the Palestinians' rocket capability?
In terms of degrading their rocket capabilities, absolutely not. And in fact, actually, the real winner out of this conflict was Iran, not Israel. Israel brokered a very uncomfortable, very unpleasant peace. That's why in the news today, I read in both the Israeli and American and Russian presses that the Israeli defense minister, Ehud Barak, is resigning as soon as the elections come in 3 months. But I think part of that is because somebody has to be sacrificed for the humiliating manner in which the Israelis conducted themselves in this war. The fact that they really fundamentally didn't make a whole lot of gains. They dropped bombs on the civilian infrastructure, they killed Al Jaber, but in reality, they at most eliminated two-thirds of Hamas's rocket supply. And that's assuming that those two-thirds were blown up and not destroyed, spent bombing Israel. The Iron Dome, which was supposed to be the latest and greatest means to stop rockets and missiles coming into Israel, worked only a third of the time.
But isn't that also because most of the rockets coming in were just so small that they couldn't even be targeted?
Part of that, yes, but also part of it was that the targeting system worked well if you were firing old Soviet Scud missiles, you know, these one
right,
giant
right.
missile. But when you fired a wave of 30 or 40,
mm-hmm.
it could only intercept 12.
But the yep. rockets are also so small that the amount of I think that we need to clarify that the amount of damage being done by a rocket that's being shot by the Gazans is like almost minuscule when you compare the catastrophic destruction power being launched by air raids on the Israeli side. Like the size of the reaction is like thousands to one, you know, and you can look at the death
right.
toll.
Yeah, where the death toll. Yeah, 166 to six, and
yeah.
that was similar to the lopsided war in 2008-2009. Now, Marchand, it looks like just before the ceasefire that the Israelis were going to launch a ground invasion of Gaza. Why did they not do that? Why did they do a ceasefire instead?
Well, the ceasefire, like I say, was a very ignominious end to Israel's campaign, because what they were hoping to do is they had almost 80,000 troops mobilized on the Gaza border. That was going to be it. They were going to, you know, sweep in and wipe out the arms caches and everything. And the fact was is that while the rockets don't do a whole lot of damage for the Israelis, it brings business to a halt. It brings life to a standstill. So for the average Israeli now, especially because the rockets were able to reach Tel Aviv, they had to do something. The Israeli government had to do something to demonstrate to their people, we're going to end this. And I mean, much in the same way that I suppose the Palestinian Hamas was trying to demonstrate to its people, the Israelis just can't bomb us with impunity. So once Israel was ready to make this ground incursion, well, the United States stepped in and we said, no, Israel, please, please. President Obama got on the phone with Netanyahu. He sent Hillary Clinton to the Middle East. They said, please, please don't launch a ground invasion, because also it would tie down. I think what we were worried about more than the moral side of it is that it would tie down a substantial portion of the Israeli armed forces. Israel is only a country of about 6 million people. So to tie down 80,000 troops is a lot. And what we were afraid of, and what one thing that Iran was banking on, is that there would be a ground invasion of Gaza, and then Hezbollah would intervene in an attack from the north, thus stretching the Israeli army beyond.
In fact, Marchand, didn't they have an agreement that they would do so if if the Israelis invaded Gaza.
Absolutely, and that came from Hezbollah's own press. So the United States was, because what the United States is trying to do now is we're hoping to launch an air campaign over Iran, destroy the nuclear sites, shock and awe, all the rest of it. But we don't want to be put in a position where we're going to have to commit significant number of ground troops into combat. And if Israel became stretched beyond its limits and Hezbollah, which has far better rockets and missiles than Hamas does, I mean, they have ballistic missiles, if they're flattening Tel Aviv, we would have to send troops. Hmm. And so...
Didn't we already send a certain detachment of troops?
We did, actually. We have around 4,000 troops there, but they're anti-missile battery. They wouldn't have to be engaged necessarily directly in combat.
Yeah, but Marshawn, talk about that, about the Iron Dome and America's role in that.
Well, yes, the Iron Dome is the missile defense system that that is supposed to, in theory, prevent rockets and missiles from flying into Israel. And it's made up of domestically made Israeli missile batteries, but also U.S. Patriot missiles, Patriot missile batteries, and Aegis shipborne missile batteries manned by Americans. But again, the principle was that these troops aren't necessarily going to be in the line of fire while they're still taking part in nominal combat support role. They're not, the chances of an American getting killed are small, and the chances that Obama or the administration would have to answer for it are also slim. So what the United States did, though, to appease the Israelis was we said, you know, look, please don't launch a ground invasion. Netanyahu says, look, I'm coming up on re-election. How do you feel if the Mexicans were bombing you? You know, if you wanted to win re-election, you'd do something. And so President Obama said, okay, I'll make you a deal. And I'm paraphrasing, obviously, but he says, I'll make you a deal. I will deploy U.S. troops to the Sinai to take part in counterterrorism operations against the militants in the Sinai, the Bedouins and the Islamic militants in the Sinai, who are transporting the arms on behalf of Iran and the missiles on behalf of Iran into Gaza. We will do that. And my sources for this, it was reported in Russia Today. It was reported in Debka File, the Israeli intelligence newsletter. Not a word of it in the U.S. press.
This is incredible. This is something people need to know, and this is going to happen how soon?
Well, actually, over the weekend, the U.S. deployed special forces to the Sinai, according to Debka and according to Russia Today.
That was actually what I was referring to a minute ago.
Right.
Didn't we send troops there? That's what I was...
In Israel, too, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And actually, you know, the ones at Sinai, and this is where the big distinction that I think most Americans need to understand is that the troops in Sinai aren't going to be combat support. They're going to be actively hunting down, quote-unquote, militants. They're actively going to be intercepting, you know, arms, blowing up tunnels and things like that. They're going to be actively engaged in combat operations.
Well, Sean, really, that was a key element of this whole war and of the ceasefire, was attempting to prevent the flow of arms into Gaza. Could you talk about where these arms come from, how they get to Gaza, and who's sending them? I mean, you know, how they get there exactly?
Well, the arms are coming originally from Iran, and what Iran does is they dock the arms ships in Port Sudan. And what they do is they dock the arms ships in Port Sudan, and then they either load them up onto trucks or they put them on other boats, and they send them up the coast through Egypt and into the Sinai Peninsula and into Gaza through the tunnels. Now, the Iranians, interestingly enough, now that the war is over, are becoming more overt about their arms supplies. I mean, now, because it's been openly discovered and even openly admitted by the Iranian government that they supply missiles to Hamas, they now said, well, there's no point in hiding it. So now there are armed ships being guarded by Iranian naval vessels headed up their way, on their way up the Red Sea towards Sinai, where it appears they plan to offload the arms, hand it over to the Bedouins, and the Bedouins will transport it into Gaza through the tunnels.
Okay, so if people can picture that this huge Sinai desert, they have to cross that to get to the southern border of Gaza, where the Egypt meets Gaza, right?
Yes, although I would like
to get it in there.
I would like to emphasize, while it's a desert, it's not... Like, people tend to think desert, they think of the Mojave Desert in California.
Right.
They think of flat, barren, featureless. Far from it. It's desert. The sand is very, very fine and grainy. It's not the thick grains like you see in a New England beach. It's very, very fine. I've been to the Sinai myself, actually. I spent a considerable amount of time there. And a vehicle has a lot of difficulty traversing it. A vehicle is a tremendous amount of difficulty. The Bedouins still live there, use camels. Because when you're in a vehicle, you're slip sliding. There aren't roads. It's incredibly mountainous. It resembles more central Afghanistan than it does, you know, the sub-Saharan desert. So, I mean,
what are the roles of the Bedouins in this?
The Bedouins are they're rather mercenary in so much as they will help whoever pays them, but also they're staunchly independent. They do not like the Egyptian government. They do not like outsiders coming in and meddling in their affairs. So when the United States deploying troops is going to be met with far less than welcome. And the Bedouins are not lightly armed either. Again, we think of Bedouins, we think of Lawrence of Arabia, we think of people running around with, you know, flintlocks and, you know, bolt-action rifles.
Curved swords,
right. Exactly. But in reality, I mean...
Magic carpets.
Exactly, which actually, that would be pretty cool. That would be pretty neat.
If only we could harness that power.
The power of the magic carpets, the Al-Qaeda's secret weapon.
Right.
But the problem that we have is that the Bedouins are very heavily armed. And not only heavily armed, they're heavily armed with decent weapons, too. And during the insurrection against Mubarak, the Bedouins blew up Egyptian police vehicles with RPGs, rocket-propelled grenades. And they were, you know, these are anti-tank weapons.
And there are no Egyptian troops in the Sinai, correct?
No, and that's one of the problems, is that the Israelis originally thought of saying to the Egyptians, well, we want you to police it. And the Egyptians said, okay, we'll police it, we'll prevent the arms from going through. And then they said, but you have to let the army in. And the Israelis said, no, Camp David, we don't want an Egyptian army in Sinai. So it was, you know, catch 22.
This is the agreement between Israel and Egypt, brokered by Jimmy Carter back in the late 70s, in which Egypt gets $3 billion a year, and I think Egypt gets close to $2 billion a year.
1.6.
They 1.6, and they, in return for which they stop shooting at each other.
Basically.
Right, yeah, we bribe them into peace. Now, how else could they possibly police that area without letting the military in?
It's, you know, the Egyptian police forces are they're more analogous to a small army than they are to any kind of what we think of as a Western, you know, European style police force. Mm-hmm. But they're you know, very heavily armed, but they still lack the muscle of the army. And technically, one of the things the Israelis discovered, and is something Netanyahu had said in Haaretz, the one of the main Israeli newspapers, Netanyahu had said, even if the Egyptians had agreed completely to police it, we know they don't have the law enforcement resources. They don't have they don't have the intelligence resources, because their police force is largely designed to curb domestic unrest, mm-hmm. not to combat insurgents in the mountains. And one of the things that happened recently, and also this was reported in Haaretz yesterday, the Bedouins, I'm guessing it was the Bedouins, I mean, nobody's claimed responsibility, but the Bedouins or the militants they work with blew up a Egyptian police and intelligence post in Rafah, which is a city bordering, that kind of straddles Gaza and Egypt. And so, I mean, this attack on the Egyptian police and intelligence forces was a real smack in the mouth from the Bedouins, and which is the reason why the United States told Israel, we will deploy troops, which won't make the Egyptians very happy. But fundamentally, the Egyptian police just don't have the resources.
But so quite now, literally, we have U.S. soldiers fighting for Israel.
In the most literal sense.
Yes,
and this is also...
They'll say ostensibly they're enforcing a ceasefire, but essentially they're acting as an arm of the Israeli army.
Absolutely. Yeah. And in fact, they're acting as an arm of the Israeli army. And moreover, this is the first time that U.S. forces have been directly involved in an attack on Iranian interests. Traditionally, you know, it was the Mossad went in, they blew up Iranian scientists, they went in and they, you know, attacked Hamas tunnels, and the blowing up of that arms factory in Sudan that was manufacturing missiles with the help of Iran for Iran was blown up by the Israelis. So this is the first time that U.S. forces will be directly involved in attacking Israeli interests.
This
right now, it's special forces.
Front. It sounds like a critical front in the war, Marshawn, the Sinai, and I don't see anything about it in the corporate press in the United States.
Well, a lot of that has to do with the fact that right now it's special forces, but after the special forces, in the coming week or so, it's supposed to be more regular troops. But I think what's particularly hazardous about this is the fact that it's not being reported in the U.S. media. Now, the U.S. media will be forced to report it once, if American troops start getting killed. And again, I think that's one thing we are I mean, just it's an unbelievable either arrogance or either under arrogance or underestimation. But we are underestimating the abilities of the Bedouins tremendously. I mean, if they start killing American troops, we'll find ourselves directly involved in combat operations against Iranian interests. And that's also one of the reasons why the Iranians are pushing us.
So, yeah, you mentioned earlier, Marshawn, that the Iranians have a shipment since the ceasefire. Are these higher-grade rockets? Are they the same thing that the Gazans used and the Palestinians used in this recent combat?
Some of them, according to Debka, are the Fajr 5, which were the highest-grade rockets that Hamas had. Those were the ones that hit Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. But now this ship is supposed to also be carrying Shahab 3, ballistic missiles, which can carry a much larger, much heavier payload. Could do significant damage.
How far could a Shahab 3 go?
Oh, that could hit Jerusalem without any trouble.
I see. 50 miles is no problem.
No, it wouldn't be a problem at all.
So and it can carry much heavier payload. So you'd interpret this as an escalation by Iran?
Absolutely. And it's an overt escalation. It's basically the Iranians are pushing the U.S. and the Israelis because they know Obama is a dithering president. They know that. They know he's a ditherer. They know that, just like with Afghanistan, the way he's like, well, you know, I don't want to look like I'm going to war. You know, it's kind of like that Tom Paxton song, you know, Lyndon Johnson told the nation, have no fear of escalation. I'm trying everyone to please. Though it isn't really war, we're sending 50,000 more. Obama's kind of like that. He's very reluctant to get directly involved. He dithers. He, you know, wrings his hands in frustration. Netanyahu, on the other hand, is very aggressive. But because of how much they rely on the United States, indeed the United States military, they are they're unable to act. So what you see now is Iran is pushing the United States with these over-arm shipments. According to Debka, I read that three important Iranian missile scientists have just arrived in Gaza. So what you're starting to see now is Iran is pushing the United States and Israel, basically saying, what are you going to do now? What are you going to do now? You couldn't launch a ground invasion of Gaza and we hit Tel Aviv. What are you going to do? What are you going to do? And the problem is that this is building up. If you imagine it's like a street gang, it's building up Iran's street cred. And there was an article I read this morning. It was on Fox News, actually. And it was showing that Iranian planes carrying Iranian special forces were flying over Iraq into Syria to help Assad. Now, this has been going on for quite a while, but in the recent weeks, Iraq had said, okay, we'll when the under American pressure, we'll stop the Iranians from flying over our airspace. Well, they haven't. And the reason why they haven't is because Iran has demonstrated beyond any doubt that they are the preeminent power in the Middle East. They are, diplomatically speaking, they are militarily speaking. I mean, here, they were the ones who, you know, brought the U.S. and Israel to a crashing halt, you know?
But on the other hand, the rockets don't really commit much damage. So how is it really helping Iran's stance here?
Because more than anything, the lack of a ground invasion demonstrated that the United States and Israel were too frightened. It wasn't so much the damage the rockets did, it was what Iran could get away with because we're too frightened to confront them. Really, that's what it all boiled down to.
So I understand that the role of the Palestinians in Gaza in a wider war, and we'll be talking about the possibility of the wider war, would be to create tremendous fear in southern Israel, perhaps as far north as Tel Aviv, and perhaps even to draw the Israeli ground forces into a protracted and stubborn fight in Gaza while Hezbollah would attack from the north. And then then Israel would get hit from all sides while Iran would enter from the east, right? I mean, Gazans would just be one part of the picture.
So in other words, that this needling is to deter a ground invasion by Israel or an all-out frontal assault elsewhere because it would show them that they're too weak at home.
Right.
Exactly.
And if they got a ground invasion in Gaza from the Iranians' point of view, that wouldn't be altogether bad, would it? I mean, because if they could tie up part of the Israeli army in Gaza while Hezbollah attacked from the north, Israel would be stretched thin. Am I right, Marshawn?
Exactly. This was for Iran a win-win because if the Israelis launch a ground invasion, great. Their army is tied down in the south. Hezbollah attacks from the north. They're tied down north and south. The U.S. is forced to intervene openly on Israel's side, which would alienate the U.S. from whatever Arab allies we have.
Because, so the bottom line, Marshawn, is this ceasefire a step towards a lasting peace or an interlude in the conflict?
it's an interlude. It's certainly, because what's happening now is Iran is basically poking us, you know, saying, come on, do something, come on. And the more they poke us, the more they demonstrate that the United States and Israel are in fact impotent. You know, the fact that the United States and Israel can't formulate a response, the fact that we can't stop the arms flow.
We've been posturing for a really long time, and it seems like they're trying to, provoke us into committing to a stance, you know, because, like, we've been undermining their government for such a long time with economic sanctions and weather warfare,
yeah.
That it's really made life very difficult in Iran for the average citizen. It seems like the country is just saying, well, get on with it already. You know, do you want to go to war or not? Come on.
Absolutely. From the Iranian perspective, it's like waiting on tenterhooks. It's like, you know, come on, are we going to do this or are we not? You know, are you going to try to hit us or are you not? And for a lot of the other Arab states, you know, who are sitting on the sidelines going, like the Iraqis going, well, we don't really want to get involved. They're now looking at this going, the United States did all this posturing, all this bluster. The military, we'll take nothing off the table. Gosh darn it. We'll be very, very angry. And then ultimately the United States does absolutely nothing. And the sanctions are only mildly effective at best because the rest of the world, the Russians, the Chinese, the Koreans, the Indians are all saying, well, you know, the sanctions are nice, but fundamentally we need oil. And
yeah, Marshawn, could you just review at the bigger picture who the regional players are tied to, like Iran, who their big allies are, or Syria, Lebanon?
Well, for both Iran, Syria, Lebanon, for Gaza as well, it's the Russians and the Chinese. But the Russians and the Chinese have made no bones about the fact that they are tied directly to. The Russians have made no bones about the fact that they're tied directly to Hezbollah, Hamas, Assad's regime, and in fact, Iran as well. Russia has sent troops into Iran, and I think what's really significant as well is the fact that Russia has a fleet of ships parked in the Syrian port of Tartus, deploying special forces. And again, this is through Debka, Haaretz, and even Russia Today. Again, no play in the U.S. media. Russian warships are now from the Black Sea Fleet docked off the coast of Gaza, presumably to evacuate Gazan civilians. Or, I'm sorry,
that's
Russian civilians.
Right?
I'm sorry. I misspoke. Russian civilians from Gaza.
So how many Russian civilians do they need a fleet to be evacuated?
Well, that's my whole point, is that it's utterly ludicrous. Also, the ships that they deployed, one was an anti-missile ship. The other was a troop-carrying amphibious craft. So, I mean, the idea of these ships, and the other is a frigate. So these are large craft, but they also could contain a large contingent of Russian naval Spetsnaz.
But military ships on a mission to rescue, presumably to rescue civilians, the Israelis can't use their blockade of Gaza to interfere with them.
Well, no, because diplomatically speaking, that's normal procedure. We've done the same. We sent Marines to Egypt to evacuate American civilians during the Egyptian Revolution. That's considered legitimate. The problem is both the Israelis and the Americans know those are ships carrying special forces bound for Gaza. But what frightens the United States and Israel is a direct confrontation. What President Obama hopes for is, and what indeed the Israelis hope for ultimately, is a shock and awe campaign against Iran. A shock and awe campaign. Pummel Iran directly from the air. Terrify the Russians and the Chinese, and they will all cower in fear before us. Well, this is utterly ludicrous. This is a fantasy. It can't possibly work. But we think it can. And so that's why, though, we won't stop these Russian ships. We're reluctant to, because what we're afraid of is a direct confrontation with the Russians, and the Russians know that. The same reason why we haven't, it was not reported at all in the U.S. media, but it was reported in the Israeli press, in the Russian press, in the Chinese press, that the Russians had special forces and still have special forces in Syria.
Guys, we need to give the phone number out.
Right, and we just also remind listeners they're listening to In Context, WPKN Live Public Affairs call-in show. And we are on every Monday from noon to 1. My name is Ken, and with me is my fellow host, Gus, and our military affairs commentator, Marchand. And on the last Monday of every month, we do our monthly war report, where we do what we're doing now, an analysis of the developments in the global wars, and we try to give you some insight in what the global political significance are of the events and the military consequences, often presenting reports that are not appearing in the corporate media, such as the reports that American troops are now being stationed in Sinai to interdict weapons going to Gaza. But yeah, the phone number. Go ahead, there, Gus.
That is 203-336-9756. Again, that's 203-336-9756. Give us a call, and we'll get you up and on the air with your comments.
Yeah, let us know what you think about the outlook for the ending this war in the Mideast. From the information Marchand's been presenting, it looks like the ceasefire is not really a ceasefire, but more of an interlude in a bigger struggle. I'd be interested in how callers think we can bring about a permanent peace to the region. Is a two-state solution still possible?
That's a good idea. That's a good idea. Let's ask a specific question to the audience today. What's your idea for lasting peace in the Middle East?
And I'd like to throw out one idea. What about a one-state solution?
Mm-hmm.
A one-state solution based upon a non-religious state.
Yeah.
A non-religious state, one based on a sort of American or Western concept of one man, one vote, not a religious state, and let the local people figure out what kind of government they want to set up. And after all, we give Israel $3 billion a year, we give Egypt almost $2 billion a year. But, you know, we have some leverage there. So I think what Americans think would be a just settlement is something the Israelis and Palestinians ought to take into consideration.
So you mean what they really need is our First Amendment? You know, the state shall make no religion a state religion. You know,
and certainly I bet this is probably a controversial idea in many quarters. But yeah, I would like to hear what listeners think about the possibility of a single state where people live side by side in peace.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean with the freedom to worship the God that you want to worship. So we're not
right.
saying, you know, end Judaism or end Islam, you know, let them
right.
Coexist. And in fact, they did coexist along with Christians for hundreds, if not thousands of years before the state of Israel occupied that territory.
So give us a call, 203-336-9756. Or do you have, is it email possible, Marchand or Gus?
I could pull that up, sure.
If some people would rather not be on the air and they'd like to send an email question or comment, and you can do so by writing to ken@mdrtalk.org. That's ken@mdrtalk.org. And they'll get your email and read it on the air. Yeah, Marchand, one area we haven't talked about, which is very important in the ceasefire, is the role of Egypt. All right. And could you talk about the head of Egypt, Morsi, his political party, and what has been the fallout for him and for Egypt at a ceasefire?
Well, I mean, for the Muslim Brotherhood, in many ways, which is Mohamed Morsi's party, for the Muslim Brotherhood, it really legitimized them as a Islamic party because as a democratic Islamic party. Because what they did is they stepped in and they said, look, you know, traditionally we believe that, you know, it's a Palestinian state, this and that, but, you know, now we're going to set our old doctrine aside and we're going to negotiate. Let's be the mediators. Let's be the bigger person here. And so amongst Egyptians and amongst worldwide, it legitimized the Muslim Brotherhood to a great extent. Then what followed shortly afterwards with Mohamed Morsi taking out these rather authoritarian measures saying, you know, his executive orders cannot be overturned and things like that, doing away with the judiciary, really almost undid a lot of the credibility that he had gained by brokering the truce.
There have been thousands of protesters hitting the street, right? And didn't they attack his party's headquarters?
Yes.
Hey, you guys, put a bookmark in that because we have a phone call. We have Jacqueline from Wilton, Connecticut.
I have a question for you guys. So my real question is, you were talking about would a single state or single secular state bring peace for the Israelis and Palestinians. But
yes,
the bigger issue that I see is not just the Israelis and the Palestinians being able to live side by side, but also being the Israelis being able to develop peace with their neighboring countries. And I wonder, if there were to be a single secular state, where would that land come from? Would it just come from Israel, or would the land also be contributed to from neighboring countries? Would Egypt give land? That's my question.
I guess you'd start with the West Bank, Gaza, and Israel, right, guys?
That's what I would think. Yeah,
I think that would have to be where it began. I mean, whether it eventually began to incorporate, and I think that's a fantastic question, Jacqueline. Whether it began to incorporate parts of Lebanon or parts of Jordan or Syria would be another question. But the important thing would be to begin it somewhere. In terms of the hostility that a lot of Israel's neighbors hold towards Israel, a lot of that has to do with the proxy war that's going on between the United States and Russia. Because while a lot of countries could benefit from a single state solution, and indeed benefit from from a peace across the Middle East, open trade, William Gladstone, the former British Prime Minister during the Victorian era, advocated peace through trade and empire through commerce. While that could be far more productive and far more prosperous, for the Russians want to attain Russian hegemony in the Middle East through their proxies. The United States wants hegemony for our proxies. So the United States sponsors anti-Iranian sentiment in places like, and anti-Shiite sentiment by extension, places like Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Qatar.
So wait, let's simplify. This sounds like it's not in the economic interest of the other world powers to achieve peace.
Well, absolutely. For the world superpowers, for the Arabs, there would be nothing better than if they could have a peaceful relationship with Israel, and vice versa. There'd be nothing better for the Israelis than if they could have a peaceful relationship with the Arabs.
Right.
But the problem is that all of this opposing rhetoric is coming because that's what the superpowers behind them are telling them to do.
So, but getting back to Jacqueline's question, though, the land right now is so segmented when you try to traverse from Gaza to the West Bank that it just seems like a no-brainer to just get rid of those blockades and make that one country, right?
You know, it would obviate, Gus, as I think you're suggesting, it would obviate this terrible issue of the settlements, Israeli settlements in the West Bank. When Jimmy Carter negotiated brokered the Camp David Accord, there were practically no Israeli settlers on the West Bank. And he said in his book, A Peace Not Apartheid, he said that he had an understanding with the head of Egypt, of Israel, that there would be no further settlements in order to ensure that they did not inflame the situation. But since then, there have been 350,000 Israeli settlers in the West Bank. Now, I don't see how you can have a two-state solution with 350,000 settlers, Israeli settlers in the West Bank.
Yeah.
But as you say, Gus, if it's one state, it doesn't make any difference.
Right. Jacqueline, do you have a follow-up?
Yeah, I do. That was very interesting insight. And my other question is, like, say hypothetically there is a single state and that there's peace between Israelis and Palestinians and settlers in the West Bank. I'm still unsure if that would bring peace between Israel and its other neighbors.
Well, I think ultimately I think it would, because a big sticking point for a lot of the Arab neighbors is that they have the feeling that Israel is pushing the Arabs out of Palestine. They're pushing the Arabs back into countries like Jordan and Lebanon, which, aside from creating tensions there, it's a rallying point for anti-Israeli sentiment.
Yeah.
And indeed, the fear that Israel is going to expand, there was a plan called the Oded Inyon plan, which came out of, I guess it would be the 1950s. It was an Israeli plan for the creation of the Greater State of Israel, which would extend from everything east of the Nile and everything west of the Tigris.
Yeah, actually, it represented Israeli government thinking on the time. And I think it was actually more recently. It was the 80s. And you can read it on the Internet. It was published as a scholarly article, and he essentially called for the recreation of an Ottoman Empire-like series of provinces in which the current Arab regimes would be broken up into smaller units that would be basically not sustainable on their own.
Exactly. And so now, while the average Israeli doesn't feel this way, the problem is that creates a paranoia amongst the Arab neighbors. So I think if you had a one-state solution, a state that said, you know, regardless of whether you're Arab, whether you're Jewish or Muslim or Christian or atheist, we are all going to be brought together in one state. And this is not an expansionist state. We're not expelling the Arabs. We're not looking to take over Arab land. We're all going to live together. I think that would dispel the fears of a lot of the Arab neighbors. Again, would there be hostility? Are there always going to be militants or extremists? Absolutely. But it would almost take the rug out from under the feet of, those who are advocating the destruction of Israel. The problem is right now, when you have a Jewish state waging war against an Arab state, it's especially with the blockades, with the settlements, it adds to that antagonism. It's it's fuel on the fire.
Jacqueline, are you still with us?
Yes.
Yeah, I am. That was great, guys. Thanks for the
dialogue.
Do you
feel that this concept of a one state secular solution is something that ought to be on the table, that ought to be in public debate? You think it merits that, or is it too far out?
I don't know. The reason that I think that it's been discarded thus far is because that Israel as an entity is really difficult to imagine it as a non-religious state. And I don't know if Israelis, I don't know, the sentiments of the Israeli people or Israeli generals and leaders, but I don't know if they would want that.
All right. Well, Jacqueline, we thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you very much,
Jacqueline.
Bye-bye.
Right.
So let's give out the number again.
Yeah.
It's 203-336-9756. Again, that's 203-336-9756. Give us a call and you get your fair share of airtime.
I think the biggest problem right now for both the Israelis and the Arabs is the fact that what we are seeing develop is this proxy wars. I also mentioned earlier, and I think that's something that we really thought it ended with the fall of the Soviet Union, but now we're starting to see reemerge with the Vladimir Putin and really new Russian imperialism. We have the Russians on the one hand pushing the Iranians, saying, "All right, guys, it's time to knock Israel out, knock the U.S. out of the Middle East." And then we have the United States on the other hand saying, to the Saudis, the Qataris, the Egyptians, and indeed the Israelis, "Okay, it's time to take out the Iranian extremists."
So the Russians have really made a comeback from the collapse of the Soviet Union, is what you're saying.
Ken,
when we hit the days of Yeltsin.
Absolutely.
Really...
Ken, take a break there because we have another phone call.
Great.
Oh, actually, he just dropped off. Oh, sorry. Call back. It was James. James, where'd you go, man?
Yeah, give us a ring back, James. We'll put you on the air.
But, I think that's one... That's one extra piece in the puzzle, because quite often we think, well, it's just Arab antagonism or it's just Israeli antagonism, and in reality there are much bigger players at work. This is what we're seeing now, is the great game, the great quest for who's ultimately going to dominate the natural resource rich Middle East, and whether it's going to be a Russo-Chinese alliance or whether it's going to be the United States and NATO.
And it's more than half the world's oil, isn't that, in the Persian Gulf region?
Exactly.
They've discovered a tremendous deposit of natural gas in the region.
Absolutely, especially off the coast of Israel in the Mediterranean. And that's why Russia has such a vested interest in keeping Assad in power, because they want access to... That's their only Mediterranean port, is in Syria. So, I think one thing we're seeing right now is the great battle between the Russians and the Chinese and the Americans for a NATO, by extension. You have NATO and the U.S. on one side, you have Russia and China on the other, and we're both funneling in arms and money to each other's opponents,
Marshawn, I think you do such a great job in laying out the broader strategic battle that's going on in the Middle East and around the world between Russia and the United States, NATO and Russia. And the corporate media presents each of our wars ad hoc as if it's each one is justified as, say, like a humanitarian intervention or a war for self-defense. And there's never any effort to educate the American people about how these wars relate to the bigger picture.
And I think a lot of that is because the media doesn't want to make people think, but it also doesn't want to frighten people, because the fact is that Americans, when they think Russia, they think of people in bread lines, they think of Yeltsin and the fall of the Soviet Union, they think of an impoverished nation. nobody, it is much more frightening to realize. And the same with China. We think of, you know, a bunch of rice farmers and paddies, but now when you look at China, when you look at Russia, these are modern industrial and indeed military powers. Why doesn't China have, why does China only have one aircraft carrier? Because they learned from the Russians, submarines are the weapon of naval warfare of the future, not aircraft carriers. Aircraft carriers, because before aircraft carriers were great to have planes take off and bomb your enemy's country, but now you have planes that can go across the ocean without having to refuel. Aircraft carriers are anachronistic. But we...
So if you just joined us, you're listening to In Context on WPKN. We're WPKN's live public affairs call-in show, and we are on every Monday from noon to 1 p.m., my name is Ken. My fellow host is Gus, and our military affairs commentator, Marshawn, has been giving us a review of recent developments in the global wars. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a ring at 203-336-9756, 203-336-9756. We'd be interested in your views of what might bring a longer-lasting peace, a long-lasting peace to the Mideast. One of the ideas that we were talking about was a secular single state solution, which would incorporate both Israel and Palestine. So what are your thoughts on that? What are your thoughts on any aspect of the global wars?
So,
give us a ring.
And I think that this is going to be, you know, what's so important here. And, you know, I know I tend to move a little fast, but the whole point that I'm trying to get around to is that Russia and China have not just pulled themselves up, but they've become superpowers, military and economic superpowers again, and now they want a piece of the action.
Hey, we have a phone call. It is Clinton from Wolcott.
How you doing today, guys?
Hey.
Hi, Clinton.
Just waiting for a friend of the post office. I'm having a little time to listen to your radio show here. I kind of think, unfortunately, and I'm not really a glass half empty kind of guy, you know, even without oil and natural gas, if you were to, you know, my family versus yours, we've been fighting for 100 years or 1,000 years, I think there's that need to get the last word in or get the last, you know, get the upper hand. So I look at it over there like, unfortunately, as a humanitarian-minded person, that our best bet is to get our people out of there. You know, and unfortunately, it's going to take these people hating the people in power who are oppressing them for thousands of years.
Mm-hmm.
And I think hopefully, eventually, you know, a younger generation of people will say, well, no, we had enough of their tyranny, and it's time to move on. I don't think we can force anything upon them.
Clint, I agree with you wholeheartedly. What do you make of the Israeli-Palestinian solution that we've been kind of bantering around, the one state, you know, one man, one vote idea?
I got a couple of things. Some will commute, like you say, about that. Recently, the Hatfield and McCoys, what do you think would happen if they were put in a prison cell together? You know, and just, you guys figured out, I mean, either one person's going to stand and then they're the guy in power, or they're all going to kill each other.
Now, but wait a minute, though. Let me just inject a little bit of reason there. That's very funny. But a lot of Israeli citizens are protesting this. You know, they want to live in peace with the Palestinians. It seems to me that it's the governments themselves that try to cling to their power.
Very much so.
Yeah.
You know, the oil sheiks and the people who've had money, you know, for thousands of years, and that's what I kind of alluded to earlier.
Yeah.
Until the people of these countries are sick of their leaders oppressing them, and they need to make them the target, not the Americans the target.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not President Obama or you know, former President Bush or a government or a party here that's looking to, on either side, you know, help negate this problem. But
how do you feel about the deployment of American troops to Sinai, and we have them in Israel as well? Are you saying that we should bring them home?
That's a tough one because, you know, part of me and my father speak of this. Part of me thinks that if Israel starts rocking and rolling in that region, you know, people are going to be pretty scared of what they're capable of doing nowadays with technology and their military, and that these guys may kind of say, you know what, maybe we should just leave these people alone. But at the same time, that could have happened for thousands of years. So, the people that are running the show over there, and unfortunately I'm ignorant on some of the names, but until they're gone and these people can say, you know what, the Americans, until people turn around and say, Americans or Russians aren't the problem here, we need to fight the Hezbollah. We need to, you know, I don't care if these guys, I'm not afraid of them anymore. If they're going to knock on my house and they're going to come in my home and they're going to take my things, then they're the problem, not the Americans. You know, and that's with any country who has a relationship with any other country. Can't, you know, a parent can't force something upon their child. I don't think a government can force something upon a person. I mean, look how we responded in our election here. Even though it was, you know, in the eyes of many people close, I think people decided that, you know, we want to go in a different direction. So until the majority, you know, the population there, you know, the many versus the few, when the many rebel against the few, then I think a lot of countries could have a lot of allies over there.
And we're going to have to leave it there because we have another call. We're going to jump to Richard from Ocean Beach.
Yes, hello. I wanted to mention, you mentioned about peace in the Middle East and like that.
Yes.
I had an idea. I mean, and I don't know if this would ever take place or if things are just too intractable, but the way I understand it, and this is my understanding of the situation, correct me if I'm wrong, but 1998, I believe it was the Good Friday Accords in Ireland. And Northern Ireland, and things have been going. The Senator George Mitchell of Maine helped broker, and the stuff in Ireland's been going on for like 1,000 years. Like my brother killed your brother, and my mother killed this one, and so on. It just never ends. But the way I understand it worked, and if this is so, it seems like kind of a brilliant thing. To first of all, more or less, take the British out of the equation and have the Protestants and Catholics in Northern Ireland and sit down and say, you know what? You have half the sewers, and you have half the sewers. You both agree the toilet should flush. You can fight, and the toilets won't flush, or you can cooperate, and the toilets will flush. You have half the electric grid? You have half the electric grid. You want to fight? Go ahead. Nobody's lights will go on. You cooperate? Garbage pickups. You have half of what needed to do the garbage pickups? You have half of what's needed to pick up the garbage. You want to fight? Go ahead. Nobody gets their garbage picked up. If people's garbage picked up isn't picked up, people get the common people will rise up and revolt. So, you know, to kind of make it that it's up to the two of them to cooperate. And from what I understand so far, that's been holding.
You know, and actually, that's a phenomenal analogy. And I think if we could broker something like the Good Friday Agreement in the Middle East between the Israelis and indeed the Palestinians, I think you would have a lasting peace, because that's what Britain did during the Good Friday Agreement, which was very, I think it was an act of diplomatic genius, because they stepped back and they said, okay, well we're not going to dictate to you who's getting what. We're going to sit you down and we're going to make sure that everybody gets their share. But it was like an impartial arbitrator. And then you had the United States step in as a third party, that party that had was not involved in. We could use the Swiss to that extent, or maybe the Swedes or the Norwegians or all of them, to help mediate a similar Good Friday Agreement between the Israelis and the Palestinians.
Because to me, that takes out a lot of the hatreds as far as somebody saying, well, Cromwell roasted 600 Catholics in a church in 1600s, or this one tortured these Protestants and whatever. Yeah. If you take that out of the equation and say, okay, now you can't say that. Now it's just the two of you sitting down figuring out how to deliver the mail, how to have have the toilets flush and the electric work and your cell phones work and like that, and now you can't blame anybody else. And if you don't do it, well, you know, you can't point to somebody else that they didn't agree to it, and a lot of people are going to be upset about it.
Exactly.
Know?
And at the end of the day, everybody's going to want to have their water running. Everybody's going to want to have their electricity. So.
Absolutely. Now, let me ask you one other question.
Time is running short,
okay,
so be quick.
Quick, then I'll take the answer off the air. Mm-hmm. From what I understand, the U.S. gives $3 billion in aid to Israel per year. Now, I know a lot of that goes to the military-industrial complex here to make weapons and ammunition and things like that. But one of the things you never hear in the corporate media and like that, okay, the U.S. is giving $3 billion to Israel, and we're always told we don't have the money for national health insurance. To me, I think that would cover it. But anyway, what is the U.S. getting in return for the $3 billion it gives every year to Israel? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you very much, Richard.
I mean, in a nutshell, and again, that's a phenomenal question, in a nutshell, what the U.S. is getting out of it is a forward operating base in the Middle East to keep the Russians out. I mean, that's really, Israel is to the United States what the Ottoman Empire was to Great Britain during the Victorian era. The job of the Ottoman Empire, and the reason it was propped up by Great Britain, was to keep the Russians out. They had no interest in the fundamental, the well-being of the Ottoman people themselves. All they cared about was keeping the Russians out, and fundamentally that's why that's what we get for $3 billion a year is keeping the Russians out of the Middle East.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there. I'm going to end up on an email from Abby, and she does not think that the single secular state will work. She says, for this to occur, Israel will have to grant full equal rights to the non-Jewish citizens, and that will erode the idea of the homeland, and not give this outcome will not give the Palestinians the state of freedom and dignity that is their right, nor fulfill the Jewish people's desire for a democratic Jewish state. Israel is highly unlikely to give up its claim on Palestine. I agree, but yeah. I also think that it's mainly the government that's not giving up its claim. I think the citizenry would be enthusiastically give up claim to this religious homeland just in order to have some kind of peace and live in security.
Well, just at the end of the day, just like in Northern Ireland with the Catholics and Protestants, the average person, all they want to do is wake up, go to work, and be able to eat and sleep and feel safe.
Yeah.
You know, it's people don't start wars; governments start wars.
Yeah. She says she ends up saying a viable solution would be to advocate a two-state solution along the lines of the 67 borders. I don't know.
I mean, a two-state solution would be a good answer, too, so long as both parties would be able to say, look, you have your bit of land, we have our bit of land.
Right.
Again, like the Republic.
What do you do about the 350,000 Israeli settlers in the West Bank?
I know.
They would have to leave.
The Israeli-only highways and all that stuff.
You would have to undo a lot of what's already been accomplished. But we're going to have to end the show, and that's going to do it for today's In Context. You can find us at incontextreport.com and find us on YouTube, In Context Report, or find us on Facebook.
And we're not going to be on again until December 17th because the first Monday in December is Steve, our general manager's report, and the second we were preempted for a fundraiser. So we won't be back until December 17th, Monday.
All right, guys. We will see you again next time.
Take it easy.
Thank you.
See ya.
Bye-bye.
Live music venue in Westport, Connecticut. For more information on the nightly entertainment, special events, and weekend brunch shows, visit theblueparrot.com or contact them at 203-557-9148. That is theblue without the E, parrot.com or contact them at 203-557-9148.
Sugar man, won't you hurry? 'Cause I'm tired of these scenes.
Monday, December 3rd, kicks off Music on Film, a winter film series presented by WPKN and the Bijou Theater with our first feature, Searching for Sugar Man. This film tells the incredible true story of Rodriguez, the greatest 70s rock icon who never was. Discovered in a Detroit bar in the late 60s by two celebrated producers, struck by his soulful melodies and prophetic lyrics, they recorded an album which they believed would secure his reputation as the greatest recording artist of his generation. In fact, the album bombed and the singer disappeared into obscurity amid rumors of a gruesome onstage suicide. But a bootleg recording found its way into apartheid South Africa, and over the next two decades he became a phenomenon. The film follows the story of two South African fans who set out to find out what really happened to their hero. Their investigation leads them to a story more extraordinary than any of the existing myths about the artist known as Rodriguez. This 2012 film won awards at the Sundance Film Festival, the Los Angeles Film Festival, the Durban International Film Festival, the Melbourne Film Festival, the Tribeca Film Festival, and the Moscow International Film Festival. The Music on Film series is sponsored by Two Boots of Bridgeport and takes place in the newly restored Bijou Theater at 275 Fairfield Avenue in Bridgeport. Tickets are $10, students $8, doors open at 6:30 p.m., the movies start at 7:30 p.m. Music will be provided by WPKN DJs and there will be a cash bar. In addition to Searching for Sugar Man on Monday, December 3rd, the Music on Film series will feature Quadrophenia on December 17th, Marley on January 7th, and concludes on January 21st with the screening of Monterey Pop, filmed at the 1967 Monterey International Pop Festival. For further information, go to our website, wpkn.org.
Oh, A little lady named Sandy spoiled all our fun, but we'll